So with that, be brief, I'd like to introduce our speaker today, Mr. Chuck Connor, Deputy Secretary of Agriculture, United States Department of Agriculture, and please give him a warm welcome.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Well, Neil, thank you very much. And ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate the chance to be here back in Iowa again. Farm bill's done, so I haven't been making as many trips to Iowa as I have been, but it's always great to be here, to be at the Iowa State Fairgrounds, and I've got great memories of this place. I appreciate the fact that this is the 20th anniversary as well of what is, I guess, considered the world's largest trade show, and by the looks of things down there, you guys are going to be have a lot of folks come through and a lot of folks here to promote a great industry, the pork industry in the United States, and I sure wish you guys well in that effort. You're not only showcasing here products and services, you're displaying the kind of innovation and, I believe, real progress that stand for an industry that I think without flinching, all of us can call easily the most productive pork sector in the entire world. Tell you folks, I appreciate as well the chance to get out of Washington a little bit. Washington has not been the best place in the world to be for the last few months, and it's good to be back among some producers. I will just tell you that for the last few months I've been caught up a little bit in what we were calling the three D's: deliberation, debate, delay. And that marked really our wrangling over this year's 2008 Farm Bill. Although I did come and want to talk to you almost exclusively about how we move forward on the many challenges we face, just being here does take me back not only to the Farm Bill debate that is now wrapping up, but frankly, it brings back a lot of memories as well. And Neil mentioned of my days on my family's farm in Indiana, and I will tell you that despite higher prices, and my brother raises a lot of corn and soybeans, he has had a horrible time. In fact, he just finished up his corn this past weekend, and that's about as late as it gets where I come from, which is about an hour south of Chicago, and he has not planted any soybeans yet. And so it's time for the Connor family to be a little bit nervous, and I know that reflects the sentiment among a lot of you out there as well. Let me just say, folks, though, that my ties to the hog industry are pretty darn close. And, when I was a youngster, Neil mentioned, brother and I talked my dad into selling the chickens. And, in those days, when you talk about chickens, understand, you talk about two young boys literally gathering eggs by hand, and selling them to the local market. And that was our being in the chicken business. So we hated those chickens with a passion, I shouldn't say that about any part of American agriculture, should I? We loved our chickens, but, doggone it, those things could be troublesome. But we finally talked them into converting that chicken house into a farrowing house. And I began to use some of my 4-H projects, which were Chester White gilts, and we began to raise purebred Chester Whites on that farm. And I'm not going to tell you that it was a market-breaking operation by any means, but I will tell you that it paid for a good portion of my education at Purdue University. And, within the Connor family, a college education was a big deal, continues to be a big deal to this day. And so, I appreciated very, very early on the impact that hogs can have in your life. I will tell you as well that those experiences did give me a certain kinship, if you will, for American producers that really no amount of being inside the Beltway and Washington policy-making experience can ever replace. I am tremendously proud, ladies and gentlemen, of the work of the U.S. pork industry and what you are accomplishing for U.S. agriculture during these difficult times. Today, I do want to look broadly at some issues affecting your industry, from farm policy to trade, big trade issues, to energy. But first order of business is to say thanks to this industry, thanks to each one of you, thanks to many of you individually for your role in leading U.S. exports to another remarkable level. Just last Friday, in fact, we announced that U.S. agricultural exports are going to hit this year $108.5 billion. $108.5 billion. That's $26 billion higher than last year. And I will tell you, folks, when I started in this business, we had a rule of thumb which basically said if you had $50 billion worth of ag exports, you were having a pretty good year. $50 billion. We're at $108. So, you know, our export numbers are just remarkable. Nothing short of spectacular. This new projection that we've got represents export gains of $7.5 billion just since last month. So that gives you some idea of the types of how our forecasts are increasing so dramatically during this period. And pork is certainly doing a big portion of this. We expect the value of pork exports to be up 35%. Over 2007. That is a big surge. That is a big surge. And that will put pork producers on track, we believe, and are projecting to set new record levels for both value as well as volume for the coming year. Obviously, we know a number of reasons for these gains. We've got to increase U.S. supplies. We do have a weaker dollar. We've got steady, robust markets in Japan and Canada. You know, and as we look to China and their rising incomes and what they are doing in terms of, in pork in particular, where they are stockpiling a number of supplies over there, you know, this is just a very, very good time for this industry to go forward on the export front right now. We can already see that the growing incomes in places like China and India, it's going to translate into something. And what that something is really increased demand for meat. And that meat is going to come primarily from the United States and from you, you as pork producers. What agriculture is achieving and what you're achieving this year is a positive trade surplus now that is in excess of $30 billion, a trade surplus. And when you consider the large quantity of imports that we have, and they are sizable, that trade surplus is very, very important to our overall balance of payments. 1 million jobs were created with these exports, ladies and gentlemen. 1 million jobs. Every dollar of export sales, you've heard us say as well, generates $1.65 back into the general economy. So, you know, so the scaling up of these dollars, again, is just something that we need to highlight over and over again, and I might add take credit for as well. So with all you're accomplishing, I think my question to you now as I come today is really what can we do for you? And I say that somewhat reluctantly because Neil's getting his pencil out, I suspect. But I will tell you that we can and we must, I believe, work together not only to keep our trade numbers growing, but to keep profitability back and bring it back to the hog sector. The success of the North American Free Trade Agreement shows what we, America, can do. In terms of increasing our agricultural markets. Today, Canada is the largest single market for all of our agricultural exports. Mexico, of course, is number two in that equation. That was not the case prior to NAFTA. NAFTA has created those markets for our agricultural producers from virtually nothing to now being our one and two markets around the globe. Now, folks, as well, let me just say that I'm not here to give you a political speech by any means, and I'm not a particularly political person. But I just got to tell you, when I hear politicians campaigning to be president of the United States saying that we need to, in effect, repeal NAFTA, or depending upon who they're talking to, perhaps talking about renegotiating NAFTA, I just got to tell you, I look back and say, you know, how can American agriculture stand up and have anything to do with that kind of circumstance, given what these markets have done for us? That's why we're saying as often as we can that Congress has not really been acting in the best interest, and some of the candidates have not been acting in the best interest of American agriculture, not only by what they're saying, but by their refusal to approve the signed Colombia Free Trade Agreement. In the 562 days since the President signed the agreement, we believe that over $1 billion worth of tariffs have been paid for our exports going to Colombia. that if the agreement had been enacted, would not have been paid. In effect, you know, that's taking $1 billion out of your pockets, out of America's pockets, and giving it to the Colombians. And we just sit back and say, why are we doing this? You know, this is nonsense. We should be enacting the Colombia Free Trade Agreement, keeping that $1 billion worth of tariffs at home. And Nick and your trade folks in Washington know this, and some of you know this as well, but what really torques you off in that situation is Colombian products come to the U.S. already duty-free. We're not getting any of their dollars in the form of tariffs or duties or anything of that point because they already have pretty much unfettered access. But yet, the Congress of the United States refuses to take up this free trade agreement. Thanks for your help on this, folks, and I'm not here being critical of any one of you because I'll just be real honest, the national pork producers have been the strongest champions for us of Colombia. We appreciate that. We're going to have to continue because we do have more work to do on this front because they're not showing any signs at this point. So that's the export situation as well, and I'll just close by saying that in the midst of all of this, please don't believe for a second that we have given up on the Doha development round, a multilateral round of trade negotiations, of reducing trade barriers. We continue to press this. In fact, just this week, Secretary Schaefer on Tuesday of this week at a World Food Security Conference in Rome said that we want an agreement, and we want an agreement that reduces and eliminates the tariffs and the barriers that are keeping our products out of these international markets. You know, we're going to continue to press this point all over the globe. And I might add that in this particular setting, more than 40 heads of state of developed countries are present at that particular gathering. So, ladies and gentlemen, in the past 2 to 3 years, as transitioning to energy, obviously we have seen some unparalleled, unprecedented increases in energy costs. We've seen rising prices for our inputs. We've seen surging freight rates. We've seen poor harvest in our major grain-producing countries, all with the underlying situation of some countries deciding and that in the midst of all of this that they're going to restrict their own exports at this point. Now, this cost, whether it's energy or whether it's trade restrictions, impacts every link of the food chain that we've got for food products going forward, and it is having a great effect on retail food prices, yes, even here in the United States, where we are now seeing food price inflation double what historically it has been for the last couple of decades, double the amount. In some other countries, obviously, it is perhaps tenfold greater than what we have seen historically. These increases account for a big share of our retail food dollar. Now, I know that you guys understand this notion of higher costs, and I know, and we've already had a number of discussions about the impact that higher costs are having upon the pork industry. Honestly, folks, we've got pretty good pork prices right now, or we ought to have pretty good pork prices. $60, $65, Neil, somewhere in that range. Okay, even as high as 70. I mean, you know, normally we would stand up here and say, you know, you guys are doing pretty well. But obviously with the cost structure that we've got today caused by these, you know, factors that we've mentioned, you know, we've got a problem in the hog industry. I will tell you as well that I'm not going to pull any punches. I'm going to say straight up that ethanol is clearly a factor in that situation because ethanol is a new demand factor in the corn market to the tune of about a third of our production going forward. Fortunately, I will say, in 2007, we did produce 13 billion bushels of corn. That was up significantly from previous amounts. And so despite large quantities going to ethanol, we actually did feed more corn to for hogs and cattle and livestock than what we did, you know, total in previous years as well. So we managed to grow that market for both feed as well as ethanol. But again, folks, I do want to acknowledge to you, and I know, obviously, you guys know this, The problem is not the supply of corn. It's been the price and the cost of that corn supply going forward, and we acknowledge that. So we do recognize that there is some hurt out there in the livestock sector, and with pork being 70% of your cost of production coming from feed, and that's higher than most other aspects of the livestock sector, we know that you guys are kind of the first in line to get clipped by this. Let me just tell you that we are not sitting on our hands at the Department of Agriculture, ladies and gentlemen, and watching this happen. We are using every creative thought that we've got on ways that we can respond. And I think, first and foremost, you are aware that we're buying $50 million worth of pork products for our child nutrition and our other domestic food assistance programs, primarily help through food pantries. This comes on top of some already previous purchases. We did $15 million worth of pork products this year. Last year, we purchased $59 million worth of products, a lot of pork products, all, again, being used for great purposes out there. And while you guys may see this as an effort to help your industry, and it is, also understand that in helping your industry, we're also making food supplies available to some of the absolute neediest Americans out there that are frankly being caught as well by higher food prices. And obviously we are a compassionate nation, and we take compassion on the needy, and this is a program that helps in that regard, in addition to obviously helping to restore profitability to your sector. I don't think most folks know that USDA does provide food assistance to one out of every five Americans, and that food assistance does now account for 70% of the total USDA budget. 70%, not very many people realize that. We, give or take, on a given year, we spend roughly about $100 billion at the Department of Agriculture. 70% of that is purchasing food to give to needy folks. The other point I would make is that we're freeing up some land in response to need for greater feed supplies. We're freeing up some land that is currently enrolled in the Conservation Reserve Program for haying and grazing at the end of the primary nesting season this summer. Now, folks, I would just tell you, I do not want you to think that our haying and grazing plan on CRP is the solution to this problem, and I would by no means, as your deputy secretary, try and convince you of that. I think it's an important program, but it's not the solution. But it should, depending upon weather conditions, significantly increase the amount of feed that is going to be available to the livestock industry, obviously particularly for the forage-eating cattle sector. At the same time, too, while noting, you know, the need to harvest some of this CRP ground, I do also want to be clear that as an administration, we continue to believe that there are enormous environmental benefits in the CRP that can't be lost. And so we don't respond positively to the notion that during these kind of times that we ought to just simply get rid of the CRP and plant corn or plant beans or whatever the case may be. There's long-term environmental benefits that the U.S. taxpayers have invested literally tens of billions of dollars in that, you know, we can't lose. But I think as we've demonstrated, that is not to say that the CRP cannot be part of the solution to this problem. We've made one announcement. Obviously, we continue to monitor this situation every day to see, you know, what can be done going forward, because, again, we recognize the need for more feed grain supply in this country. 24 million acres in our announcement will be eligible for haying and grazing. That's a lot of land out there, ladies and gentlemen, a lot of land. Now, again, it'll be predicated on the weather this summer. If it stays wet and cool, there's going to be a lot of forage out there on 24 million acres that people will be, you know, take advantage of. If it does as it often does after, you know, periods of cool and wet where it turns hot as hell and dry, you know, that 24 million acres isn't going to have much forage there for probably to even justify putting the $5 a gallon diesel fuel in the tractor to go out and cut it. And we acknowledge that, which is why, again, I do not characterize this as the solution to the problem, but it potentially could be an important part of that solution. And third, in terms of the impact of ethanol on our feedstock supplies and costs, as well as food costs, we are looking to the future as well. And through our farm policy, we do intend to lay a foundation for an investment in the next generation of biofuels, and that next generation will not rely solely upon grains and oil seeds for that particular fuel production. You know, I got to say, folks, we were obviously disappointed in the outcome of the farm bill, and you guys know that, and I'm not going to dwell on that because we do like to look forward within USDA and not look back. But we were disappointed in that bill, and you guys know the outcome of how that came to be. But there are a number of provisions in that bill that I have to acknowledge to you as well that we're very, very happy about. The biofuels provision is one of those because of its emphasis upon developing non-grain-based sources of energy supplies going forward. As well, I will tell you that the Farm Bill provides grants and loan guarantees for a lot of biorefineries out there that will use this technology, this non-grain-based technology, I think, to create a great deal of economic activity out there in our rural areas. And, you know, despite better times among some aspects of American agriculture, we still have a jobs issue out there in our rural communities, and we need to continue to focus on creating more jobs out there among our small towns in rural America. Finally, as well, the other part of the Farm Bill that we were especially pleased with was the conservation title. And, you know, as we put together our own Farm Bill recommendations, this was something we put a great deal of emphasis upon. We like EQIP. Just, you know, pure and simple, we like the EQIP program. We favored greatly increasing funding for that program, and Congress did respond to that. Currently, EQIP is about $1 billion a year. It'll be about $1.75 billion a year under this Farm Bill. And, you know, in case you don't know, obviously a big portion of that is set aside, 60%, for the livestock sector. And that money will go for livestock practices, manure management, waste management plans, lagoon systems, all the kinds of things where, you know, the pressure to do it more, you know, to do it better, to do it cleaner, are constantly being, you know, pressed upon you guys out there. I think this program will be a partner with you in meeting those kinds of demands. So we're real happy about that as well. And I will just say that, you know, despite our differences with the Congress on the Farm Bill and the fact that we do like many of these things, I want you guys to know as well that within the Department of Agriculture, we have very highly dedicated professional people who are determined to implement this Farm Bill quickly and to the best of their abilities, despite the fact that it is a bill that we did not support. And we have already put that in place. We've had implementation meetings within the agency. And again, I will just tell you that everyone is very, very enthusiastic about getting this rolling, getting the payments out to the producers in a timely way, getting the programs available to them, and I might add, finally, getting mandatory country of origin labeling in place by September 30th of this year. We are not highly enthusiastic about mandatory country of origin labeling, but I will tell you, with the work of your industry and our cattle folks, there's been some improvements made to this program where I will tell you, we think it is workable. It is not going to dramatically change the way we do business. It's a workable program. It's our intention to have that in place by September 30th. Probably won't see our enforcers out there on October 1st, you know, checking retail stores. We're going to give a grace period here for compliance, but it will be the law of the land on that September 30th deadline, according to the mandates of Congress. So we look forward to see how all that shakes out. It's worked fairly well for seafood, which has been in place now for a little over a year, and it's been okay. And again, this is not a program that would have been to our liking, but you know, we do our best, and whether we like the program or not, and I think our career folks have done a pretty good job and are going to do that when we put this broader program into place as well. I think with that, let me just summarize and tell you, you know, I'll tell you, a quick story again about, my tenure in the livestock business. And as I've said before, part of my college education was paid for using Chester White pigs, which I started out with a 1/4-H gilt, and kept pigs out of that gilt, and ended up actually having a fairly sizable herd by the time I went off to school. Understand the context of that, as I'm 50 years old. Larry and I are about the same age there, and that meant that I was, in the livestock business in the early 1970s. It was when I was growing all of this. So while on a much smaller scale, and I don't want to compare a project of a high school kid to, your livelihood by any means, I do understand what some of the difficult times, that you guys are going through. And I remember in those days, my dad actually raised a lot of seed corn for Asgrow. And if you have ever done the seed corn business, and I'm not sure it's still this way exactly, but you've got, rows of female stalks where they get the seed, and then you have the male stalks, which typically do not produce a lot of, a lot of corn on those male rows, to the point where a lot of producers, just simply disc them under. My dad did not do that because he couldn't, bear the notion of not, maximizing every single penny off of that field of land. But, in this particular case, he would come back after all the rest of the harvest was done and harvest his male rows off his seed corn. But one of the problems you had was there, there were end rows of male corn on all the seed, and they would want to come in and get this seed very, very early. And so they would typically, the custom harvesters would just run over the end rows of male corn. And so for 2 years, actually, I was able to feed my Chester White herd by literally my brother and I gathering, by hand, the rows off of that male corn before the custom harvesters came in and got it. And, in those days, you couldn't switch back and forth between corn and beans quite as quickly as you do today. And it was, it was an all-day affair to change that corn head. And so my dad was busy harvesting beans. He couldn't put the corn head on to cut the end rows when they were ripe. And so literally, we had to harvest it by hand. But my point to you folks is I want you to know I understand the difficulties your industry faces. But I also understand just how industrious we are. And how we make things work, how we make this marketplace work. And I might add, just having come off a major farm bill debate, I appreciate how you make this marketplace work with a very, very limited amount of government intervention. And I commend you for that. You guys have a lot of close friends within the Bush administration. I may not, given the times that we're in, I don't know whether that's good or bad from your perspective, but it's a fact that you have a lot of close friends in the Bush administration. You have been our ally on so many things, from trade to environmental issues, just a lot of different fronts. We appreciate that. As we wrap up here between now and January 22nd, which is when all of us will be out of office, I know we still got a lot of challenges before us during that 8-month period, whether that's, additional pork buys or CAFO regulations or whatever the case may be. We've got a lot to do over the next 8 months, and I want you to know we look forward to finishing strong with you guys. You've been such a partner with us, and again, keep in touch with us and help us do all that we can. I'm not going to promise profitability from $6 and $7 corn, but we're going to do all we can to work with you guys to take your best ideas, our best ideas, and see how we can, again, just like in the old days of, going out and cutting the corn by hand, how we can, in a very ingenious way, make a go of these times. So thanks for having me here, folks.